Round that there is other data, Marty Owen, Sam Town Council, Amber Walner, Randy Town, Police Council.
And police court, Mark Owen, Jane, for the appellant Deborah Brown, the executor of the estate of her deceased husband Greg Brown. And police court, this case, in a nutshell, comes down to whether an attorney can withhold information from an employee or from an agent that the attorney knows will place that agent or that employee in danger. In this case, in danger of death. When he assigns that agent or employee a task. In this case, what happened was...
Is this an agent or an employee or is it an independent contractor?
Well, this is an independent contractor.
All right, so this is not an employer-employee relationship.
Well, Your Honor, what I would suggest is that this court has examined that in the A.H. versus Rockingham Publishing case written by Justice Whiting, in which the court looked at an independent contractor case involving a paperboy who was sexually assaulted while on his paper route. And Justice Whiting examined the facts of that case and said because of the aspects of that case in which the newspaper controlled where and when the paperboy was to make the deliveries, that was going to be treated exactly like an employee-employer relationship, and also went on to cite an earlier decision, Peel case from early in the last century, in which this court had rejected a jury instruction saying that an employer owes a lesser standard of care to an independent contractor than he owes to an employee when he is putting that person at risk of harm. And so what I would suggest is we've got two analyses that must be performed. One is there a special relationship that exists between Jacobs, the attorney, and Brown, the process server? And the question, as this court has framed it on many occasions, some recently, is, number one, is it a relationship that is recognized by law already? Or number two, are there facts, particular facts and circumstances in this case that suggest the existence of a special relationship would be found? And we're not asking this court to, as the appellee suggests, to create a new special relationship or an exception for attorneys process servers. We submit that this is an exception that's already been recognized by the court in the A.H. versus Rockingham Publishing case, in as much as it is an employer independent contractor case. And in this case, I would also point out that the principal did control the question of when and where the task was going to be performed, in that he told Greg Brown where to serve, process, when to serve it, told him to serve it at his girlfriend's house in the middle of the night, and then later, when he was unsuccessful in serving it in that fashion, he told him that the defendant in this civil case is leaving the country. And told him, serve it immediately, wherever you can find him, as soon as you possibly can, before he leaves the country. So, in this case, what we have is a situation where there's an imbalance of knowledge. The attorney knew that this person was behaving erratically, that he had that he was armed, that he was not just armed, but sleeping with his gun under his pillow because he was paranoid, because he believed that there were people who were trying to deprive him of his property and of his family. And the attorney in this case actually formed the subjective belief that he was dangerous.
To the extent that none of those facts are in your amended complaint, what are the facts in the amended complaint that would establish that foreseeability that you're arguing?
Well, First of all, what I would suggest is that the amended complaint certainly asserts that he knew that he was armed, that he knew he owned a gun, that he was likely to cause harm to others once he was served, and that he requested Brown to serve him personally and told him where and when to complete that service. Now, when the circuit court addressed the issue of primarily the issue of whether a special relationship existed between Brown and Jacobs, we offered a proffer of additional facts that we would allege really with respect to the foreseeability and the imbalance of information. And the court rejected that, and we filed the request for reconsideration, and the proffer is contained in our amended complaint that that contains the additional facts that we submit provide the factual background that establishes this relationship and foreseeability.
But if we conclude that the court did not err in not granting your motion to amend, would you agree that the facts are contained within paragraph 5 as to the foreseeability?
Paragraph 4, paragraph 5, and paragraph 6 are the foreseeability facts in the amended complaint. Now, I would submit that if the court was focusing on whether there was a special relationship between an attorney and a process server, which the court was, it really wouldn't make any difference as to whether there were additional foreseeability facts. And I respectfully submit that that was behind the decision to deny the motion to amend. This motion to amend was made immediately following the grant of the demur.
I don't understand your argument that even if we find a special relationship, that we still would not have to find that it was foreseeable.
Oh, you do have to find
it's
foreseeable. What I would submit to the court is that on foreseeability, this court has examined any number of cases. First of all, going back to the AH case, the Rockingham Publishing case, Justice Whiting helpfully in that decision stated what would have had to have been present in that case in order for him to have decided that the case should have been sent to a jury. And in that case, he said that that if there had been evidence that that the defendant knew that the plaintiff was in danger of being assaulted on that particular route, that he would have sided with sending that case to the jury. In that case, there were three sexual assaults over a five-year period in different areas of the city. And the court concluded, how was the newspaper to know that this same criminal was going to assault this paperboy on this particular race, on this particular route? In this case, the attorney knew who the criminal was. He knew who posed the danger. And he set up a set of circumstances that didn't just create a possibility that he might be on a route where this criminal was going to be lurking. He guaranteed that this decedent was going to come into contact with the person he believed posed a risk of harm or death. And in the Peterson, Virginia Tech case, this court looked at the issue of foreseeability. And in that case, what the court did was the court looked at the subjective beliefs of the agents of Virginia Tech and looked at what information that they had and their protestation that they did not believe that there was a still current threat looming on the Virginia Tech campus, and concluded that those were not unreasonable conclusions. In this case, what we have is the defendant in this case, who himself subjectively, in contrast to the Virginia Tech case, believed that there was a danger, and he showed that belief by actually doing the research to find out whether he could go to court to force the Mr. Abid to surrender his firearm because he was afraid that Mr. Abid posed a risk of harm or death to someone once he was served with this complaint. And in this case, I would submit that even applying the Peterson analysis for foreseeability, one would have to conclude that Mr. Jacobs was unreasonable in his concerns for the safety of people associated with this case, notwithstanding the fact that he nailed it, in as much as it was a handgun crime in which Mr. Abid actually did use his gun to shoot and kill Mr. Brown in the pursuit of the task that he was assigned by Mr. Jacobs. So I would respectfully submit that foreseeability, if you apply the Peterson logic, is satisfied. I would also point out that when we look at this special relationship, this court has repeatedly looked at, back in the St. John's Wood case and the Daly 7 case, looked at things like imbalance of knowledge and control. And I would respectfully submit that while I submit that this is in the nature of an employee-employer relationship, one in which we ought to apply, the court ought to apply the AH standard, treating Mr. Brown as an employee for purposes of this analysis, the imbalance of knowledge and control that exists in this case buttresses that conclusion as well. In this case, Mr. Jacobs knew Abid. He knew the danger that he posed. Mr. Brown did not. Jacobs exercised direction, control, when, where, and how to serve, and he selected the most dangerous time to do it. With that, I would ask to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
3 minutes and 10 seconds.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, my name is Grant Penrod. I'm an attorney from Harrisonburg, Virginia, and Bruce Wallinger and I represent Sherwin John Jacobs, who is the appellee in this case. There is no general duty to warn in Virginia, and that is, I think, the most important thing about this case. And what the problem
with that, you may be right about that statement, but this isn't a general duty case. This has to do with specific knowledge that somebody had that exposed this man to danger and, unfortunately, death.
In order to overcome the general duty, Your Honor, there's a two-part test. First, there has to be a special relationship, and then second, there has to be foreseeability. And what the appellant is encouraging this court to do is to turn that into a one-part test by saying if the crime was foreseeable, therefore there was a special relationship, which really turns this into a situation not where we have no general duty to warn, but where we have a rule where if a crime is foreseeable, there becomes a duty to warn, and that's not the law.
I think there's... In all fairness, I think his argument is that there are some independent contractor relationships that mimic employer-employee relationships, and that's one of the holdings from AH, and that's also, I think, he's trying to fit his peg into that hole.
AH was very, very different from this case. AH did not rule that generally there was a duty, a special relationship between independent contractors and principals.
He wants us to accept that AH is very similar to this case. That's the argument I want to hear from you, is why it's different from this case.
There are three reasons why it's very different. One is the AH. In AH, we had a child, and in this case, we have an adult. Two, in AH, we had a newspaper boy, and in this case, we have an independent private investigator who owned his own private investigation business. That private investigator comes to the job with a knowledge of how to be a private investigator and how to serve process. Presumably, the paper boy, the 13-year-old, does not come to the paper knowing how to do that job. The paper boy is much more like an employee. And the third reason is, if we look at the rationale behind special relationships in Virginia at all, which is explained in Tabulata, which goes back to the Middle Ages, there's an entrustment of safety aspect. And While it might be reasonable in H that the 13-year-old entrusted his safety to the paper, we would not expect that a process server would entrust his safety to an attorney who has hired him to serve process.
Now, there are two other factors, though, that I'd like for you to comment upon, one of which was that there was a fixed time during which the papers had to be delivered, and there was a fixed route that the young boy had to utilize. And those are the factors that made it more like an employer-employee relationship than an independent contractor relationship. And those are two of the factors that I believe your opposing counsel is relying upon. So would you comment on those?
The principal, any time a principal hires an independent contractor, they have to give some direction. If I hire someone to come to my house and paint it, I have to tell them what color I want it to be. I have to tell them where my house is. And I might even tell them when I prefer for them to show up. But the painter, just like the process server in this case, is still using his independent judgment about how to accomplish that job. There's been no allegation that the attorney told Brown whether or not he should arm himself when he went, what type of vehicle he should drive, whether he should approach the person directly, whether he should call him first. These are all things that are in the expertise of the private investigator, of the process server, that person knows how to do. The attorney doesn't know how to do all those things because attorneys don't serve process because we can't serve process. We're not allowed to under the rules. So again, I think those are very, very different.
But let me ask you a question, if I might. And I'll tell you up front, the reason why judges ask hypothetical questions is they're trying to test the premise. Mm-hmm. So we change the facts a little bit.
Sure.
And I understand your premise, but mm-hmm. let me apply these facts. Let's assume for a moment that we know that the front yard, the side yards, and the backyards of this man's house, who's a former munitions expert, is filled with landmines. And the lawyer knows that.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, go to his house, go to his front door, serve this process. Are you suggesting that under those circumstances where the knowledge is so superior on the part of the person giving the direction that there is no duty on the part of that person with that superior knowledge?
That would certainly be a very different case than this one. I'm not sure.
Well, you have to stop right there. I want to know how it's different because if I look at it and I don't see any difference. So go ahead and tell me.
Well, one of the differences, if we separate the conclusory allegations from the second amended complaint, even what we're left with is Abed owned a gun. Abed was a defendant in a divorce case, and Jacob's parents knew that he did not want to be divorced or he was afraid he might lose his children. This is not materially different than any other domestic relations case. People don't often want to be divorced. People are often afraid that they're going to lose their property, and people in Rockingham County very regularly have firearms.
What about the either allegation or conclusion Abed was likely to cause harm to others through use of the gun or otherwise?
Well, that's a conclusory allegation, and I think what the prior cases of this court established is that, first of all, Wright instructs us that violent crimes are generally not foreseeable. And other cases that this court has ruled in, the court has required someone to plead facts from which it can be reasonably ascertained that someone would be able to predict that which is normally not predictable. And this crime in particular was so outrageous, was so violent, that it would be unusual, it would be almost impossible for anyone to predict it unless they had a knowledge not only that this man owned a gun, but that he was a psychotic killer, because the crime makes no sense. The fact that he killed the process server did not gain him anything in his divorce case. It was a completely irrational crime. The violence of this crime was out of all proportion to everything else that was happening. There's no way that Jacobs could have predicted this outcome.
Well, isn't the issue here not so much prediction? You keep saying that the process server, it knows how to do this.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I agree with you, but it seems to me the issue is, have you shared enough information with the process server that you know
mm-hmm.
that will allow the process server to make this service of process Under the circumstances, and I'm looking at what he's plaintiff is alleging in the second amended complaint. I mean, you got paranoia is in there, behaving strangely, belief that people are conspiring to take his property and his children away. There's a gun. There's an active effort on the part of the lawyer to have the firearms removed from the house. And other things. There's also, to be blunt in this, there's also an ethnic issue in this that has to do with the relationship between men and women in the Middle East. Mm-hmm. And even that's in the pleading. And so the question seems to me is not, is this on just bare bones foreseeable? Is it foreseeable under the circumstances where the extra knowledge of the lawyer could have been communicated to the processor?
I don't think that it is, Your Honor, and I'm reminded that I didn't completely answer your last question, and I think these things tie together. You had asked if we had minefields all around the house, if there would be a duty to warn. There has to be the special relationship first, and the foreseeability does not create the special relationship, because in Virginia we have a rule where there is no general duty to warn. So if I, as a stranger to someone else, know that they're about to walk through a minefield, I don't have any duty to warn them about that minefield. And perhaps that's what the appellant is struggling with in this case, is if somebody, maybe what they're asking is there should be a duty to warn, but there isn't in this case.
But this person isn't a stranger. At worst, I mean, he's an independent contractor, and he may very well have exerted, as Justice Mims was talking about, enough control to have an employee-employer relationship. So it's not a stranger.
I don't think, while he may not have been a stranger, I don't think there's enough here to get him into an employer-employee relationship. And again, I'd highlight the differences we've already talked about between AH and between this case. And especially if we look at the history of the special relationship in Virginia, in every one of these cases, there is an aspect where somebody has an expectation that they are entrusting their safety to someone else. That's how the special relationship exception was created, because we had innkeepers and we had common carriers who were taking care of people who were out in the wilds. And the customers that were coming to them could not have that kind of control. If we look at the cases, I think, where this court has declined to find a special relationship that's instructive, and one specifically would be Kellerman and Burns. Kellerman was the case where the parents entrusted their child to another set of parents. Burns was the case where there was a fight at the school. And in both of those cases, this court said, there is no special relationship. And in Kellerman said, we're not even going to review foreseeability because there is no special relationship. And certainly, a private investigator does not entrust his safety to the same extent that these children, safety was entrusted to the school or to the other sets of parents. This would be a great expansion of both the special relationship exception in Virginia and the logic behind why we have the special relationship exception. The knowledge and control issue, really, it's not so much knowledge and control over the facts of the specific case that come in when we look at this. It's knowledge and control over how to do the job. And the attorney does not have the knowledge and control over how to be a process server that the innkeeper has over how to run their inn, or that the common carrier has over how to maintain their vehicle, or even how the employer does over how to maintain their workplace. One thing that the appellant brought up was the appellant has mentioned repeatedly that personal service was requested in this case, and has used that to try to argue that the process server was put into danger. I want to point out to the court that our service statute actually requires this. The service statute is not cumulative. It's not a cafeteria plan that you can pick from. Personal service has to be requested first, and especially if you've got someone who's leaving the country, it makes sense to get personal service, because you don't want them to come back later and try to overturn the divorce by saying, I never got served, you posted it on my door, but I didn't live there anymore, or I never got the mailing. This is just the personal service aspect of this is just standard civil procedure. It wasn't an intention or even something that purposefully put someone into danger. Also, the appellant mentioned the court's final order and I think made some statements that went beyond the record in the court's final order. The court's final order is explicit that the demurrer was granted for two independent reasons. One, because no special relationship existed, and two, because the facts were insufficient to show foreseeability, including the additional proffered facts. There's nothing in that order that suggests that the court had made a decision that there was no special relationship and so that it wasn't willing to consider any further facts, and that if there had been sufficient facts, the court's mind wouldn't have been changed. That's just simply not in the language of the order.
The court has an interesting terminology in the order which confuses me a little as to which standard of foreseeability she applied, assuming that there could have been inferred that there was a special relationship. The languages were reasonably foreseeable by Jacobs as an imminent probability of harm. I don't know which standard the court used.
Well, what I would say, Your Honor, is that is somewhat confusing, except the higher standard should apply in this case. If we look at the cases where the court has established the higher standard, I'm running out of time. I think I argued this more artfully in my final brief. But the reason behind the foreseeability standard is the same as the reasoning behind whether there's a special relationship. And it's how much do you entrust your safety to the hands of the other person.
But if we followed AH, and if it was an independent contractor agent situation, wouldn't the standard be reasonable foreseeability?
I don't think AH held that. If the court were to hold that the standard was reasonably foreseeable, then it would. But what AH said was that because we have this minor child, the court is going to use the same standard of care that it would have used for an employee, and then goes on to state that might have been different had we had an adult. So I don't think AH stands for the proposition that the reasonable foreseeability standard of care would apply to every situation where you have an independent contractor in principle. And I think beyond the specific facts of that AH case, you would actually apply the heightened standard because of the differences. And I'm just about out of time.
No, you are out of time.
Thank you.
Rebuttal. 3 minutes and 10 seconds.
First of all, the trial court did conflate the two standards, and I would respectfully submit that the standard properly applicable to this case would be the reasonable foreseeability standard, which has been the only standard that the court has ever articulated as the appropriate standard for an employer-employee relationship or an independent contractor relationship. Second of all, in AH, in response to a number of the court's questions, The dissimilarities pointed out by the appellee may be factual dissimilarities, but the similarities and dissimilarities pointed out by the court, or the issues pointed out by this court in AH as the determinative factors in treating the paperboy as an employee, were the factors of time and route. Those were the two factors that the court looked to and applied. In this case, I would also point out that that this is not a run-of-the-mill divorce case, which the appellee has consistently suggested that it was. In this case, Greg Brown, I was deprived of the opportunity to make these choices about what precautions he should take or about whether to even accept this assignment as a consequence of not being told this information that Mr. Jacobs considered so significant that he was prepared to, or at least indicated his preparedness to go to court.
Certainly your second amended complaint fleshes out some of the facts as to whether this attorney knew or didn't know this gentleman was dangerous. The trial court denied your motion to amend. She looked at the fact that discovery was complete and that you had already had a prior amendment. where is the abuse of discretion in her denial of your...
Well, with due respect, those weren't the bases of the trial court's rulings. There was discovery was not complete. The complaint had just only been amended to add Mr. Jacobs as a party. This was the first proceeding upon that amended complaint. It was the only hearing. There was no discovery conducted after Mr. Jacobs was added to the lawsuit, whether written or oral. So we respectfully submit that the trial court erred in not applying the standard directed by the rules of the court to liberally grant motions to amend, particularly following a demur. Then I would also point out that in response to the court's minefield issue, that this is like that. This was a minefield. And my time has expired, but although in this case it was Mr. Jacobs who possessed the information about the minefield, and the duty and special relationship can arise from the facts of the case.
Thank you very much. The court will be in recess until 9 o'clock tomorrow morning.
All rise.